John Topping, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you, Rebecca.
We're happy to have you here. In Oklahoma, of course, we've experienced our fair share of tough weather, particularly recently. It seems that we've been getting a number of storms, snow incidents, et cetera. And obviously, this part of the country has been dealing with drought conditions for some time. So is this a pattern that we're going to see into the foreseeable future, or is this just kind of a fluke?
I think the statistical odds of these extreme events will be increasing. No single flood or drought or tornado can be blamed necessarily on climate change. But we know there's going to be climate variability, and humanity is going to be threatened by that. And it doesn't matter which is the cause if you're facing that sort of crisis.
What are some of the statistics that you use in talking about climate change? We hear so much debate about whether it's true that there is climate change or whether it's just a fluke and that things are going to go back to what they were before. How should Oklahomans think about this? Because we've heard everything, and it's rare that we get to speak to somebody who's devoted their entire life to studying this issue.
Well, I wonder if you could add a little bit about what some of the specific risks are that we could potentially be facing, not just here in Oklahoma, but around the world.
Right. Well, first on this whole issue, we're certainly seeing a strong warming trend. I mean, the President of the State of the Union addressed whether one agrees with him or not and other issues. I mean, it was right in the sense that 12 of the last over the last 15 years, we've seen 12 of the warmest years of roughly the last century that we've been taking climate records. I mean, that's incontrovertible. There are thousands of meteorological stations around the world have essentially fed into that and so on. So there is warming underway. It does seem to be associated with climate change. The risks are that we will see accelerating sea level rise. We've seen a modest amount of sea level rise over the last century. It's possible we could see at this point, it's actually likely we may see as much as 3 feet of sea level rise. And that is going to be a big concern, particularly for the Atlantic and the Gulf Coast of the U.S. and, of course, small island nations as well. What's significant, let's say, on the Atlantic coast is for every foot that you see of sea level rise, you're likely to see about 200 times that of shoreline retreat. So if you see, let's say, a 3 foot rise in sea level, that means roughly 900 feet of shoreline are likely to be lost. We can do certain things. We can protect certain cities by building dikes or other seawalls around them. But it means we would lose our pocket beaches in the U.S. And other countries would be facing this.
So what we saw in Manhattan is waiting for us in the future.
Exactly. We actually several years ago did something talking about the big disaster that might happen in New York from a nor'easter and or hurricanes. It was a fascinating thing. It's just posted if one goes on the big on the climate.org site on the Big Apple, and it was remarkably close to what actually happened. We organized a conference in 2006 where we had a number of scientists from schools, particularly in New York, that were looking at essentially creating barriers. London has already done some of this to protect itself. And I think some of the major cities may be able to do that. Miami and New York and London and so forth may be able to survive. But you've got a lot of areas, the North Carolina coast, a lot of other areas that are going to find it very difficult. So that's one huge problem. Depending on how much loss we were to see of coastal areas, you could be talking about hundreds of millions of people over the next century who could be forced to move. We're already seeing the first environmental refugees, some of the first actually in the United States, in Alaska. It's essentially native villages. There are 200 and some native villages that are at some degree of risk on the Alaska coast where they're threatened by a combination of permafrost thaw and sea level rise. There are a number of them that are already looking at relocating from this. So, it's happening. And I think one of the mistakes in climate is to assume that the United States is immune. I mean, I would submit we're probably the most vulnerable of all the industrial countries. I mean, there are a few countries like Bangladesh and Indonesia and Vietnam that perhaps are even slightly more at risk than we are. But we have several risks on the coastal areas, particularly in the on the Atlantic coast and on the Gulf coast. We have a risk of both storms and also a sea level rise. The sea level rise is a little less of a problem on the Pacific coast because the coast typically are fairly steep there, and the, you know, the shallower the coast, you know, the more the shoreline retreat will be. But still, you know there are concerns there. So that's a problem. But you also have places in the U.S. Southwest where drought, you know, could become a severe problem. You have other places in the country, Oklahoma, Alabama are certainly affected by this, where severe storms inland are a major problem. We don't really know the science yet in terms of tornadoes. You know, it looks likely that a hurricane intensity will increase. It's possible tornado intensity will. It seems plausible. But at this point, it's an open research question.
Well, as you mentioned, it is a transnational issue. Even if states like the United States wanted to escape some of these issues related to climate change, it's inescapable. Do you foresee in the future that this will bring states together to cooperate to find solutions, or is this going to create some sort of violence or security concern as resources become scarce and people in large populations start moving in response to some of these threats that you mentioned?
Well, I think the challenge is to bring people together before the crisis is fully upon us. And my hope is that this generation of people who founded Facebook, who've grown up with social media, who started from the time they were practically preschoolers playing games online and so forth, who are going to be profoundly affected by climate change, can be leaders. And they can come together, and we can have maybe 100 million people who can work on these challenges. Maybe not just, you know, spending time doing Angry Birds. They can still do that, and they can do World of Warcraft. But spend maybe an hour or two a week on some practical problem-solving solutions. And if we can create this kind of collective collaboration, that can be more effective than the 200,000 or so of us who run back and forth to meetings on climate and energy and often generate more in emissions than we, you know, we create of solutions. And that's critically missing. You know, we're not doing nearly enough of that. We're, you know, you look after Katrina, where we hundreds of billions of dollars in damage, the government coming in for much of it, the same thing in Sandy. We spend all sorts of money after the fact. We feel bad for people who've been hit hard. It's very hard to spend small amounts of money in beforehand. It's sort of a little bit the same thing in the healthcare system. We don't spend nearly enough in prevention. We spend a lot in the last 6 months of somebody's life. We need to, in addressing a lot of these challenges such as climate change, we need to do a lot of planning beforehand when things are a whole lot cheaper than they are after the disaster has hit.
Well, the United States has been criticized to some extent for not being more of a player on the international stage in regards to climate change or being proactive. What can the United States do to not only deal with our internal issues regarding climate, but deal with some of the external issues that are going to affect us all?
Well, I think there's several things. We've played a very creative role in pushing reduction of emissions of black carbon, soot, and other so-called short-lived climate forcers, where you can get big human health gains, and you can get benefits from the climate right away. Former Secretary of State Clinton played a very positive role in getting that. 25 countries have moved in that, including some of the big polluting developing countries as well. So we're seeing some progress there. U.S. has played a good role there. We played a very positive role in the Arctic, which is an area that's very threatened. The Arctic Council, where the U.S. is one of the eight country members, and then there are six indigenous tribal organizations that are also members. We can play a very creative role there. So I think, this is important. I've worked I'm the chair of a subcommittee of the American National Standards Institute Life Cycle Assessment Committee, where we're looking at a new life cycle assessment that may affect projects, energy development projects in different parts of the world, but particularly undertaken by U.S. companies. And we're looking at the U.S. perhaps having the strongest voluntary standard for these major project life cycle standards of any country in the world that would be factoring in emissions to the Arctic, looking at effects on the Arctic and an ocean acidification, where if this gets adopted in the U.S., and we're hoping this will be adopted by later this year, it's been out for public comment, and now we're moving toward a formal submission of this. If this happens, it could become the basis for an international standards organization that would govern major projects. So companies that wanted to get a kind of green label, would look at this. And there's very strong interest in Scandinavia and some other countries in moving if the U.S. does adopt the standard. And it's largely a voluntary standard. But sometimes the advantage of voluntary standards, if they affect major projects, is they can come in 10 years faster than EPA regulations, which everybody sues over and so forth. And so I'm optimistic that the U.S., even though I don't see a lot of action coming out of Congress in Washington, can move. It's also significant on black carbon there is a kind of political consensus. It was interesting. Earth Day, April 22nd in 2009, almost 4 years ago, Senator Inhofe, who's generally been a climate skeptic, and Senator Kerry, and Senator Boxer, and Senator Carper all joined together in sponsoring legislation to ask the EPA, U.S. EPA, to do an analysis of reductions of soot or black carbon, and their potential effects here and abroad. The U.S. EPA did this, and it's a remarkably positive standard, and it's helped in some of the work that's now happening through the Climate and Clean Air Coalition. So that's something where even people who are climate skeptics breathe air just as other people do, and I think that's critical to make these things happen.
Well, we'll go ahead and end on that positive note. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.